I'm here tonight, as you can see, to talk about a topic in astronomy. And good night for this, actually. It's a nice clear night out here tonight. My background and why I'm standing here is I was formerly an engineer in the U.S. military space program. I believe it says something about this in the brochure, actually. I went into that program as an atheist and an evolutionist, and I came out a creationist and a Christian in that order. I became a creationist first from the evidence I saw, and then that led me to the conviction that I needed to become a Christian as well. So I bring that up for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're often told that as Christians, we only believe the biblical account of creation because we're obliged to, because it's the foundation of our faith, being that book. And that if we looked at the evidence objectively, that surely we would see through such nonsense and acknowledge the true facts of the evolutionary model. Now, there are many, including myself, for whom the opposite is true. We became persuaded by evidence first that creation was true, and then became believers in the Lord. Now, the second thing I'll say with that is that creation evidence is not sufficient to make one a Christian, because there are many who do accept this evidence and yet do not accept the Lord. But it is a stumbling block for many. And one of the reasons I speak on this subject now is to remove the stumbling block where I can for those for whom it's a problem, and to strengthen believers in our mutual faith. Because truly what God has done speaks of his glory, and it's worthwhile to proclaim that. So, as you can see, our topic tonight is stars and galaxies. There is a whole bunch of things we could talk about in astronomy. This is our particular topic tonight. Before we talk about exactly where these things came from, it would be helpful to discuss exactly what they are. So a star is basically a hot ball of gas out in space, typically a very big ball of gas. I need to speak louder?
Yes.
Okay, I'll bring this closer. Close enough to trip on now. Hopefully that won't happen. So a star is a big hot ball of gas out in space. Is that better? Volume? And they come in different sizes, different colors, different masses, different compositions, but they all share the same basic characteristics of being, as I said, hot balls of gas. Now, many people know that. Some people aren't familiar with what a galaxy is, and a galaxy is a collection of a whole bunch of stars, all orbiting a common center of mass. Now, galaxies can be smaller, with a few million stars, or larger, with hundreds of billions of stars. An estimated average for a galaxy is roughly 100 billion stars or so. That would be a 1 with 11 zeros after it, so that's a large number. Now, we look in the sky on a clear night, and we can see our own Milky Way galaxy stretching across the sky, looking as a band of clouds almost. It is actually a disc-shaped galaxy. Since we are inside of it, we are looking into the edge of it, and we see it edge-on, thus it appears as almost a stripe across the sky. Further zooming in here in this little film clip shows that other galaxies are visible in the sky as well, if you have good enough equipment to see them. There are just a handful that are visible to the eye without the aid of a telescope. If you do have a good telescope, you can see lots and lots more. They come in different sizes, different shapes. Here we see an elliptical galaxy being the blob-like structure that's dominant in the picture here. Here we see a disk galaxy that's more edge-on to us. And if we had time, we could look at a lot of other photographs of that as well. We'll see some more as we go. Now, tonight we're focusing largely on the naturalistic model, naturalism meaning the idea that everything formed by natural processes. You'll also hear me call this the evolutionary model, and some people object very strongly to somebody talking about astronomy and using the word evolution. In fact, I was called a liar by one of the more prominent science writers in the country for applying the word evolution to astronomy. I pointed out to him, though, that astronomers use the word evolution all the time to describe natural formation of planets, galaxies, stars, and so on. And this is just 6 textbooks that I found within about 30 seconds of searching. There's probably a couple dozen more I could have put up there if there were room. My point is that when you hear me talk about the evolutionary model, I'm using it as an astronomer would use it. I'm not talking about plants, animals, Darwinian processes. I'm talking about natural formation of these objects and development through natural processes over time. So there's the evolutionary model on the one hand that says all these objects came about through natural processes with no creator being involved over billions of years. Now the Bible tells us that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, that he did so on the 4th day. In so doing, he said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs, seasons, days, and years. God made two lights, two great lights. The greater light to rule the day, that would be the sun, and the lesser light to rule the night, that would be the moon. And then almost as an afterthought, it says, and he made the stars also. So the Bible's primary focus is on the place we live, and the rest of the universe was made almost casually by God, or at least the Bible describes it that way. So that's the biblical model, and we'll come back to this. Let's talk a little bit about the evolutionary model first and see how well it holds up to what we see in the sky. The naturalism model overall starts with the Big Bang, that there was nothing, then nothing exploded, producing everything. In the process, it formed gas, and then the gas collected into stars, and the stars formed into galaxies. Now, we don't have time to talk about the Big Bang model itself tonight. We'll skip all the problems it has at the beginning of time, according to the evolutionary model, and we'll focus just on stars. This is a time-lapse movie here I'm showing you. And the question is, there's a whole bunch of stars we can see in the sky. Where do they come from? If you're going to have a theory of everything, which is what the evolutionary model claims to be, then you need to explain where stars came from, because they are the dominant form of matter in the universe, at least visible matter. Other than a few planets here and there that we know of, everything we see is either stars or collections of stars, or maybe a few clouds of gas here and there. So if the evolutionary model is to be worth anything, it needs to explain where stars come from. As we will see tonight, it does not do so. Now, you're told in the media that we can see stars forming today in places like the Eagle Nebula, which I'm showing you a photograph of here. This is a fairly famous photograph when it came out a number of years ago. And they tell us that in places like this, where we see clouds of gas out in space, that stars are being formed within them. So how does this process supposedly happen? Well, we're told that there is a big cloud of gas out in space, that over time, that cloud of gas will shrink, because you have a cloud of gas with individual atoms and molecules of gas. Each one has a slight gravitational pull on everything else in the cloud. Therefore, all the particles are attracting each other. Therefore, the cloud will shrink and compress. As gas compresses, it gets hotter, if you remember your chemistry. Keep shrinking, keep getting hotter, keep shrinking, keep getting hotter. Eventually, you reach a point at which compression is sufficient to ignite nuclear fusion inside of the cloud, and now you have a star. So we are told that gravity is sufficient to form stars out of clouds of gas. What they don't usually talk about, at least not in the science programs and so on, is that there's another effect going on in these clouds as well, and that's gas pressure. So I have here a can of compressed air. Now, when I pull the trigger, air comes out. Why does it do that?
Because it's under pressure inside.
Because it's under pressure inside, and it's a lower pressure outside. So when a passage is open from inside to outside, gas flows from higher pressure to lower pressure. Now, why was nobody worried when I did this? Why was nobody worried that when I opened the passageway, that rather than gas coming out, that all the air in the room would get sucked into the can, and we would all asphyxiate and die? Not going to happen, right? As compressed as this is, it is grossly insufficient to have its gravity, because there is a gravitational force here, but the gravity is much weaker compared to the gas pressure, which is much stronger. So notice I can hold compressed gas in my hand only because it's in a can, a sealed container. Where's the can out in space? Well, there is none. These clouds of gas have no container. Therefore, gas pressure will dissipate them before gravity can compress them, and the clouds will go away. Now, it's true.
So why aren't the astronomers mentioning that when they...
Oh, we'll get to that. So it is true that if a cloud is already dense enough, it will compress under gravity. Gravity will be strong enough at that point to overcome gas pressure. But all the clouds of gas we see in space are not anywhere near close being that dense enough. So all the clouds we see are going to dissipate rather than condense. So how do the evolutionists get around this? Because they're, of course, just as aware of this as I am. Well, they propose three possible solutions for how we can get around this issue. They invoke compression, cooling, and collisions as the three possible ways to overcome this problem. So let's talk briefly about each one. Compression is invoked by a supernova explosion out in space. I'm showing you here a galaxy with a supernova next to it. The supernova is actually about as far away from us as the galaxy is, but as you can see, it's shining almost as brightly as the parent galaxy itself. It's a small object, but these explosions are very violent and produce a lot of energy output. As another example, we have here the Crab Nebula, which is the leftovers of a supernova that went off in the year 1054. Chinese astronomers watched this thing happen, and it was visible in the daytime for quite a few days. So here's the idea for star formation. We have a supernova explosion out in space. It produces a shockwave front from the explosion, which compresses the clouds, gets them dense enough to where gravity can then kick in, overcome gas pressure, and stars begin to be born within the cloud. So that's reason number one why stars can supposedly form, compression. Reason number two is cooling. The idea here is that these explosions not only have a shockwave front associated with them, but they also blow particles into the cloud. And similar to if you had a pot of water that was just barely beginning to boil, and then you dump a bunch of rice in it, what happens to the water? It stops boiling because it cools off because you just dumped a bunch of cool grains in there. Well, same idea here. If you blow a lot of cool dust into a cloud of gas, that will cool it down, which will reduce gas pressure, which will allow it to shrink, and hopefully gravity will then be strong enough to shrink it all the way to becoming a star. So that's reason number two. Reason number three is collisions. I'm showing you a photo here of two galaxies that are apparently colliding. And along the front of the collision, things are being compressed because gas clouds are slamming together at rather high speeds. And in some cases, that's sufficient to overcome gas pressure, and so you can have stars form. So I just gave you three possible ways that evolutionists say stars can form. But there's a common problem to all three of these, which you may or may not have picked up on. Supernova explosions are old stars of certain types and masses at a certain stage in their history. So when a star of a certain type gets to a certain stage in its development, if you will, it blows up. So a supernova explosion is the explosion of an old star. Grains of particles, it turns out, can't have come from the Big Bang. The Big Bang can't make these grains and particles. They had to be formed inside of stars as well, and then distributed into space by supernovas, which again are old stars. And then galaxies that are colliding are themselves made up of stars. So does anybody see the problem here with all three of these explanations for making stars? In all three cases, you need old stars to make new stars. So the evolutionary model has a chicken and the egg problem on a universal scale. You've heard the joke, you need chickens to make eggs, you need eggs to make chickens, round and round we go. Well, the evolutionary model has this problem on a much bigger level. They can't get stars out of the Big Bang. Don't they recognize this? Well, yes, they do. I'm going to share with you a bunch of quotes tonight. These are all from evolutionists who believe in the billions of years and so on. Okay, I'm not quoting any creationist here. The process by which an interstellar cloud is concentrated until it's held together gravitationally to become a protostar is not known. Literally hundreds of ideas on how stars are formed have been advanced in past decades. However, we are still far from any real solution. If you can see the citation here, this is on page 405 on one of my astrophysics textbooks. So after you wade through 400 pages of math, you get to the shoulder shrugging, making you think you've just wasted all of your time. So what you're not being told about star formation is that it relies on gravity to pull gas clouds together, which is a real effect, but it's very weak. Gas pressure is also a very real effect. It's much stronger. It's dispersed in the clouds instead. All of the ways to get around this requires old stars to make new stars, and nobody can explain where the first ones came from. The Big Bang model, therefore, cannot have made stars. So when you look up in the sky tonight, remember, it's empty. A little bit of irony there. Okay, so what about galaxies? Well, if galaxies are large collections of stars, then if you can't make stars, you can't make galaxies either, which is why you get quotes like this one: a completely satisfactory theory of galaxy formation remains to be formulated. It has always been difficult for astronomers to explain why stars are clumped into galaxies instead of being spread out more uniformly in space. There shouldn't be galaxies out there at all. And even if there are galaxies, they shouldn't be grouped together the way they are. The problem of explaining the existence of galaxies has proved to be one of the thorniest in cosmology. By all rights, they just shouldn't be there. Yet there they sit. It's hard to convey the depth of the frustration that this simple fact induces among scientists. The formation of galaxies in larger scale structure remains TMIUPIMA, the most important unsolved problem in modern astrophysics. Now, here's a mention of larger scale structure. Let's talk about that for just a moment. The evolutionary model can't make galaxies. It also has problems with the fact that galaxies are found in clusters. Almost everything you're looking at here is a galaxy. Galaxies tend to clump together out in space, but that's the opposite of what the evolutionary model predicts. This creates something called the lumpiness problem. It turns out space is lumpy, at least from an astronomical perspective. Here's a quote that explains what that means. One of the most cherished notions astronomers hold about the structure of the universe is the notion that if we look at a large enough scale, we will find the universe to be smooth and homogeneous. From Einstein on, leading cosmologists have assumed this statement to be true. Not only Einstein, by the way, the entire Big Bang model relies on this assumption. It's a foundational principle of all the math in the Big Bang, that the universe is smooth in its distribution of matter. Yet the fact of the matter is that the universe we know is lumpy. In our own neighborhood, it consists largely of empty space, interrupted only by the sun, the planets, and the bits of rock we call asteroids. Looking outward, we find a universe in which the visible mass is clumped into galaxies, separated by large distances, the galaxies themselves being gathered into clusters. Try as we will, there seems to be no way to get a large enough view of creation to see a smooth, simple structure. Scientists find this state of affairs irritating. Why would a scientist be irritated by data? We're supposed to welcome data, right? Because if you're after truth, then the more data you have, the more likely you are to achieve truth in your models. If you're irritated by the data, well, that tells you, one, your model doesn't fit, and number two, there's an emotional reaction going on, and a bit of bias as well. So how lumpy is the universe? Difficult to show in a slide, of course, but you see these slices here. These are made because these sky surveys have gone out in one little angle looking out in the sky, producing kind of like a pie-shaped wedge. Every little dot you see over here is a galaxy. So you see the galaxies are gathered together into filaments and clusters. The initial discovery was that galaxies come in clusters, and then as we look further out, we found the clusters come in clusters, called superclusters. And now they're talking about superclusters. In between all the clusters and superclusters are bubbles and voids of empty space. Again, remember, space is supposed to be smooth, but space is turning out to be very lumpy. It does not fit the evolutionary model. So what you aren't being told about galaxies is that, number one, they shouldn't be there. Number two, they're distributed in such a fact that's causing problems for an atheistic model of how all this happened without a creator. So having mentioned a creator, let's get back to what the Bible says about all this. The Bible tells us that God created stars and galaxies and heavenly objects in general for several reasons. Among them are for signs and seasons for us, to sustain life on earth, and to declare his glory as creator. Let's focus a little bit on the second one of those. And it turns out that this little system of an earth orbiting around a sun turns out to be very well designed to have life here. Our sun specifically, because we're talking about stars tonight, let's talk about the sun. Our sun is vital to life on Earth. The sun actually provides, indirectly, all the oxygen we breathe, because the sun's light powers photosynthesis in plants. Plants produce oxygen, and we breathe that and survive on it. Were the sun to go away, oxygen here would go away as well. Not that that would matter so much, because by the time that happened, we'd all starve to death or freeze to death, because the sun is also vital for both food and warmth. Warmth is kind of obvious. I mean, the Earth would be a very chilly place without the sun, not much above the temperature of space. It also provides food, though, because sunlight powers the lowest elements of the food chain, algae and phytoplankton and so on, and then larger creatures eat those and larger creatures eat those all the way up until we get to us. So, and of course, plant life as well, all being powered by the sun. So the sun is really the source and sustainer of life on Earth, not the initial source, of course, that was the Lord, but sustaining life here since then. Now, none of that really matters to the atheists, because the atheists tend to say things like this. Carl Sagan, who's a creationist now, said, "Who are we? What are we?" Oh, he passed away a few years ago, for those who didn't get the joke. Sorry. Okay, that one fell flat in his face, didn't it? All right. Carl Sagan said, "Who are we? What are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than people." There's a cheerful outlook on life that he had. Other people have said similar things. Our star, the Sun, is rather ordinary. In many respects, the Sun is entirely a run-of-the-mill entity. Nothing special about it. Our Sun, so important to us, is merely an ordinary garden-variety star. So if you listen to people like this, they'll try to convince you that our star, nothing special, run-of-the-mill, ordinary garden variety, and so on. None of that is true. The Sun is the opposite of being mediocre. First of all, the Sun is brighter than about 85% of all stars, which benefits us. It has more mass than 92% of stars, and that's a very good thing because low-mass stars are very unpleasant places to try to live next to. About 75% of all stars are red dwarfs.